It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. Plenty to cover. Let's start out with local, if that's okay with you.
Sure, let's go.
All right. Let's start out with, it looks like there's a riff going between the city and ShareWheel.
Yeah, ShareWheel is the, people who aren't familiar with it, it's a homeless advocacy group founded in 1990 when homeless built a tent city down near the Kingdome. And they've been managing tent cities off and on over the last 15 years. In the process, they've also become the largest provider of shelter beds in King County. They run about 300 in the city now in 14 different shelters, along with a women's emergency weather shelter. And they are facing loss of their funding from the city and the closing down of those shelters on March 31st. Now, ShareWheel has run into problems in the past with the city. There's a lot of friction. A lot of people don't like Scott Murrow, who's the guy who essentially founded ShareWheel. He tends to rub some people the wrong way. Above and beyond that, Share is self-managed. The homeless people actually run their own shelters, which is one reason why they can win bids for operating the shelters, because their costs are so much lower. They don't have professional staff telling the homeless what to do. But there's been a dispute brewing for a while over a program called Safe Harbor that the city has been implementing, which is essentially a computer database to track homeless people. What the city has been requiring now for this past year, and it's a program that's been in the works for several years now, is a requirement when a homeless person enters a shelter that they give all sorts of information to the shelter provider, which then passes it on to the city database of things including a social security number, disabilities, mental health, drug and alcohol use, all domestic violence history, all that kind of stuff, which is a real serious violation of privacy. And in some cases, such as, women trying to escape domestic violence situations where, a violent husband, might be trying to track them down. Also, fairly dangerous to the homeless person. And in a case where other homeless are running the shelter, you're basically giving that information to the person you're sleeping next to. It was of great concern to ShareWheel. They're refusing to go along with the program. And so on March 31st, the city has decided to pull the funding for ShareWheel. So ShareWheel, in turn, is has decided that if the city doesn't reverse itself, if the Nichols administration does not do that, that ShareWheel will open three tent cities in the city of Seattle, which they have not done during Nichols' reign over the last 4 years. They've had several various places on the east side, but they haven't had any in the city. So they're going to pick three parks. They haven't picked them yet, but one will be on the north side, one will be downtown, and one will be somewhere in South Seattle or West Seattle. So they are hoping, and other advocates for the homeless as well are hoping, that the city will reverse itself on this, because they really can't afford to lose that many shelter beds for the homeless. I mean, you're talking out of 2,500 shelter beds available in King County on any given night, for over 8,000 homeless people. You're talking about losing a significant chunk of those beds over this dispute. So they're urging folks to contact City Hall, contact the mayor's office, contact various city council people, and try and get the city to reverse itself and back down. And if that doesn't happen, I'm sure we'll hear more about it, and they'll be asking for people to help out with logistics and supplies and whatnot for the tent cities themselves.
Do you know what the city's thinking was in creating the Safe Harbors program?
I really don't. As usual, it's for the homeless people's own good. That the city compiles this kind of information. I assume they just want the information. They want to understand who the clientele is and what their needs are. But why you couldn't do that in the aggregate, why you have to keep specific records on each individual and attach it to their names and social security numbers and all the rest of that, that's a pretty serious overstepping as far as I'm concerned.
All right. Moving along, looks like the city council has whittled down about 99 names down to 14 semifinalists for the council.
Yeah, and some real surprises on that list. There's not a single white male on the list, which is somewhat different than the current composition of council. And they're replacing a white male, Jim Compton, on the council. So there'll be a little bit more diversity no matter who is picked. Most of the people picked are sort of standard, community activist, good government types, not many boat rockers, but a couple of real surprises. Juan Bocanegra, who is known to most activists in town, he's been around for many, many years, active on Chicano and Native American and poverty issues. He's run various downtown shelters and service providers over the years. Been very active. He's run for city council a couple times too, I believe. He made the final list of 14. Also, Sharon Maeda, who's a pretty well-known activist, made the list of 14. The list will be cut down further to 6 finalists on Monday. So, if people are interested in backing either Boca or Sharon Maeda or anybody else that they fancy from the list, get on. Email them now or leave a message on the phone or get on the horn first thing Monday morning before the decisions are made, but that'll be coming right up on Monday. I'd be pretty surprised if either Boca or Sharon made it to the final list of 6, but stranger things have happened, so it's good news that they got this far.
All right, and it looks like at the state level that Dwight Pelz is doing well.
Yeah, he's claiming this is for the race for Democratic State Party chair, which is decided in about a week. And since Chris Vance resigned for the Republicans will make a selection of a new party chair on the same day. Pelz is claiming that out of a field of several candidates, he has commitments from over half of the Democrats' central committee to support him for the party chair. He has the endorsements of both Christine Gregoire and Patty Murray. So it looks like he's pretty well got it sewn up, which for Dwight is a good thing. He needs a job. He tried to get on city council and wasn't successful, and he got districted out of his county council seat. So we'll see how he does with the Democratic Party. Paul Berendt has been fairly successful over the last 11 years. Dwight has a history as a community activist before he became first a state legislator and then a county council member. So he has some organizing experience. I don't know what kind of a fundraiser he is, and that's a big part of the party chair's job is to raise money for local candidates. So we'll see how he does, but it looks like he's going to be your next Democratic State Party chair.
Well, in terms of, let's say, your politics, do you think Dwight Pelz would be an improvement over his predecessor?
Probably, yeah. He had some questionable stances when he was running for city council. He's fairly close to Greg Nichols in terms of a personal relationship, but he was very supportive of Paul on South Lake Union development, for example, and some other things that raised some eyebrows. But he's a fairly aggressive liberal. He's fairly partisan, and he's not afraid to back away not likely to back away from a fight. He's likely to have more of a spine than most Democratic Party leaders traditionally do. How he picks and chooses his battles is another question, and he might well become more conservative once he's in the position. But I think on balance, his background is certainly more encouraging than Berendt's was when he first came into the job.
Yeah, we'll be talking about people that aren't afraid to back away from a fight in a little bit. let's, before we go there, talk briefly about... I was surprised and can't quite figure it out reading about Google this week, the corporation that runs one of the major search engines on the Internet.
Yeah, they refused to give the federal government information that it's looking for in the course of its trying to resurrect something that people may remember, the Internet anti-pornography bill that passed Congress a few years ago and was then struck down by the courts. The feds are trying to resurrect that, and in doing so, they want to be able to show that the legislative remedy is easier than any other kind of remedy in order to prevent people from being able to come up with pornography when they search the internet. So they asked Google and Yahoo and Microsoft and AOL to provide aggregate data of or to provide data of computer searches that the people engage in. Originally, they wanted every search conducted over a two-month period. Yahoo and AOL and Microsoft complied with the request, but basically bargained the feds down to a one-week period. But they still complied to it. They still gave people, you know, everybody's search request records for a one-week period, and they haven't said which week it was, but they did do it. Google, on the other hand, has refused and is in a confrontation with the federal government over this, which, for anybody who's familiar with Google, is a real surprise. Google is not exactly known for its respect for customers' privacy. It's actually quite a bit in the other direction, where their collection of data on customer use of their facilities, and they're turning around and not only applying it to their own products but making it available to other vendors, has really raised the alarm amongst electronic civil libertarians. You know, whether they're doing this because they're concerned that they've already had had that image and it's getting out there in the public and is hurting their reputation, and they wanted something to give people the other different impression. I don't know what their motivation is, but it's pretty uncharacteristic for them. But I'm glad they're doing it. Because it really is an overreach on the behalf of the federal government. It once again, as is often the case with the Bush administration, real abuse of federal power to invade the privacy of ordinary citizens.
All right. Well, moving along to national.
We wanted to talk about Olympia.
Oh, you're right. You're right. I totally skipped over that. We've been wanting to do that for a couple of weeks now.
Yeah, we keep running out of time to do this. So, originally I was going to preview the legislative session, but we're into it now, and several interesting bills are making their way through the legislature in Olympia. Of course, the state now with $1.4 billion to play with in surplus that they didn't expect to have. They've got it because of tax revenues from a improving economy in this state. Gregoire wants to put most of it into reserves, the reserve funds that have been depleted over the past few years as we've had budget shortfalls. But of course, there are always the pet projects that different legislatures and interest groups want. SEIU has some fairly expensive requests in for legislation to help child care workers various other workers get more money. But there are some other interesting proposals as well. Adam Klein is spearheading an effort to get a shield law into place for Washington State that would allow journalists to protect their sources. It's somewhat flawed. Most states have some sort of shield law in place. There's none at the federal level. And there's none in Washington State. The one that Klein is introducing, unfortunately, it only applies to people who make a, quote, substantial part of their income from reporting or media work, which excludes most freelancers, that excludes most bloggers, and it's a real weakness in the bill. So if people would like to see, I hate to use the term amateur, but people who aren't paid or aren't paid as much to do journalistic work or political commentary, give Klein's office or other legislators a call and ask that they urge to put that in. We have people who want to put fixes in for WASL. We have people who are trying to tweak the healthcare mess in the state. Yesterday we had House Bill 2661, which is the gay civil rights bill, passed through the House. It goes to the Senate for its first hearing on Tuesday. And of course, Representative Finkbeiner, the former Republican caucus head in the Senate, has reversed his vote on that. He voted against it last year, and it failed by one vote. So the chances of this finally passing after a couple decades of attempts are very good. Of course, Reverend Ken Hutcherson has launched a somewhat ludicrous boycott to try and stop it. I don't know how he plans to boycott Boeing, but and he promised he would announce it on Focus on the Family. Now Focus on the Family says that they never had booked him and that he lied to AP about that story. So that boycott may not apply, but even if it does, it's kind of a joke. There's a very good chance that the gay civil rights bill will pass this year, and that's a real good thing and a tribute to the people who've worked on it over the years. Washington State Supreme Court, incidentally, is poised quite possibly before the end of the legislative session to rule on the legality of gay marriage and the Defense of Marriage Act. So that could become a very, very big issue during the legislative session as well. And then there's some counter-recruitment bills, opt-out bills. The bills are HB 2986 and Senate Bill 6681. They don't, and the Senate bill is a little bit better of the two. They don't, unfortunately, include the assessment test that the military does in high school and then turns around and uses to target individual students for recruiting. But they do limit the ability of recruiters to spend time on junior high and high school campuses and give parents the ability to opt out of giving the military information on students. So that's a good thing, and that's in the legislature this year also.
All right. Well, just been having a lot of coverage in the last couple of days about a big dragnet for eco-terrorists.
Yeah, yesterday 11 people were indicted by a grand jury in Oregon over a series of 17 fires between the years 1996 and 2001, a couple of which were here in the Seattle area. There was a horse slaughterhouse in Redmond that was torched in 1997, and then more recently the UW's Center for Urban Horticulture. And 11 individuals were indicted, most of them with ties one way or another to Eugene, but they live all over the U.S. West. And, even if they did these crimes, and I don't particularly want to endorse arson, even if it didn't harm anybody in terms of bodily damage. I think calling these people terrorists, as the federal government is doing, is a bit of an overreach. But it's typically been done for people who sort of subscribe to the ideology of the ELF and ALF and whatnot. And there's a couple of cases in Oregon that are precedents to this. If their legal history is any guide, are real worrisome. One guy in particular who was convicted of essentially torching, I don't remember if it was a pickup truck or an SUV, but something where, it was probably about $20,000 worth of damage or something. And he got 20 years in prison for that conviction, whereas somebody who's been simply been motivated by pyromania or an insurance scam or revenge or whatever would have gotten far, far less. And the judge essentially said when she threw the book at him that this is because of your political beliefs and this is to send a message to other people. So the danger for this, for people who have been charged not with these crimes but conspiracy as well, and it was a 65-count indictment, they're going to spend the rest of their lives in prison if there isn't a real vibrant support movement to support some of these folks. And even if there is, they're in real legal jeopardy right now. And they're in jeopardy specifically because they are political activists, as opposed to having any other kind of more pedestrian quote unquote criminal motivation. So keep an eye on that.
All right. Moving along, the Democratic Party doesn't appear to be overly anxious to raise its voice too loud in D.C.
God. Yeah, the Democrats have really failed us badly on Samuel Alito, and I talked about that a little bit last week. The real telling part during the hearings was that each of the Democratic senators on the Judiciary Committee chose to ask the questions themselves, and with the exception of Russ Feingold, who probably did the best job of the lot, none of them are lawyers. So you had non-lawyers trying to pin down one of the best lawyers in the country on legal questions, and is it any surprise that he not only swatted them aside with these, but also managed to look very sympathetic on the cameras in the process. You know, if the Democrats had been serious, they would have found a good and sympathetic lawyer who is a legal expert, who is expert in cross-examining a witness, who is an expert in having an audience, whether it was a jury or the rest of the Senate, come away with a desired impression of the witness. The Democrats didn't do that. They thought it was more important to have FaceTime on national TV than it was to nail Alito to the wall and change the minds of senators who might have been persuaded to change their minds. It's probably too late now. You have no Republicans at all out of the 55 in the Senate that are saying they're even leaning against voting against Alito, much less have committed to do so. You have at least four Democrats who've either said they're going to vote for Alito or are leaning that way. So it's not entirely clear that a filibuster would, that they even have the votes to hold it. But Democratic leaders have said repeatedly this week that it's fairly unlikely that they will filibuster. They had a meeting, caucus meeting on Wednesday, and came out saying that they were, that almost everybody argued against mounting a filibuster. You know, I really don't understand why they're rolling over on essentially what is the Republican seizure of the third branch of government on this. But we had another development this week, which also speaks to the Democrats' lack of spine. That was the competing proposals between the Republicans and the Democrats on how to quote unquote clean up corruption in Congress. And there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the two proposals. They did slightly different things, but neither one of them seriously addressed the problem. Neither one of them called for public financing of elections, which is what, you know, one of the first essential steps you need to get the corrupt corporate money out of politics. And the Democrats are just as wed to it as the Republicans are and don't seem to understand that they should be owning this issue. They should be the ones that are taking advantage of the Republicans' quote culture of corruption to sweep these guys out of off of Capitol Hill, and they'd get a lot of support for it, but they're too wed to their money to do that.
They would.
It's very disappointing.
I think they would get a lot of support, but wouldn't you expect that, you know, that broom would sweep them out as well?
It'd be more likely, but you know, it'd certainly be likely for some of them. Again, in order to be swept out, you would have to have Republicans embracing that ethos of clean government. And I don't know that Republicans know how to run without big corporate money.
I don't think either of them do. All right, moving along. NSA updates.
Well, I wanted to talk a little about frist and delay.
Okay.
Louise Swatter, who's a two-decade-long representative on Congress from upstate New York, got on Air America a couple days ago and accused both Senator Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, and Tom DeLay of having day traders within their offices that were taking advantage of inside information on pending congressional legislation in order to conduct day trading, presumably on behalf of corporations that are donors to the two congressmen. This could be a big deal. Frist, of course, is already under investigation by the SEC for insider trading. Tom DeLay is in all kinds of trouble. And it wouldn't surprise me if you had Republican committee chairs that are guilty of this also. This could be just as bad as the Abramoff scandal. I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more attention, but it very well could.
All right. NSA.
Yeah, Congressional Research Service, which already earlier this month on January 6th came out with a report saying that that the warrantless domestic spying program of George Bush was of dubious legality, came out this week with another finding that the failure of the White House to notify each member of the Intelligence Committee of the House and of the Senate was also a violation of the law. So you have two different violations of the law. And of course, in the case of reauthorizing the NSA spying program, it's one that Bush has done repeatedly and has vowed to continue to do. You know, this is a White House that has said quite clearly that it will continue to violate the law and that has violated the law in the past. Congress's own research arm, bipartisan or nonpartisan, I should say, research arm has now said that it's illegal. You know, what more information does Congress need to act on this?
All right.
Or maybe we should just vote them all out in November.
Assuming that would work. Coming this month to Fox, the Osama tapes.
Yeah, well, I doubt Fox would broadcast it. And actually, the latest Osama tape was audio only. He didn't videotape it. Of course, the CIA might find out where he actually was by looking at the background. It can't have that. Aside from Osama's having plugged William Bloom's book Rogue State, which is an excellent book, I'm kind of worried that Osama and I read the same things, but. Aside from that, it was most interesting that Osama offered a truce. He said that, long term, we'd be willing to enter into a long term truce with the United States. We'll lay down, our arms and our bombs if you do. And this has gotten no media play in the U.S., even though bin Laden's tape itself did. And, of course, the White House has ignored it completely and will completely ignore it. Bush isn't about to give up his war on terror because it means too many good things for the Republicans. It makes him a wartime president. It allows for expansion of government powers, and he gets to play war and yada, 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 enriches all his friends, et cetera. But he's not going to give up his war on terror as long as he stays in office. But it's something that really should be considered, just as negotiating with the insurgents in Iraq should be considered, because these wars are destroying America's military, are draining the budget, they're doing horrible things to the U.S.'s moral standing in the rest of the world, and they're killing an awful lot of people, for no real purpose. So it's something that I think people should encourage their legislators to consider. If you want to talk about, well, bin Laden needs to be brought to justice, George Bush has killed 10 times as many civilians in the last 5 years as bin Laden does. If you're not going to bring bin Laden up Bush and Cheney and the rest of them up for crimes against humanity, not that much of a stretch that you wouldn't do it for bin Laden either.
Moving along, finally, Iraq.
Yeah, the results from the December 15th election finally came out this week, and not much of a surprise. It's basically what we've expected. The Shiite clerics, or the coalition of Shiite clerics that has dominated the country's election, won 128 of the 275 votes in the legislature. That's not a majority. They will need to form a coalition government, and it will probably take a long time, even longer than it did the last time around, when they were supposed to form a government in a matter of weeks, and it took several months. Two Kurdish parties got 58 seats, and two Sunni parties got 55. The Kurds and the Shiites probably will form the coalition government. They will probably exclude the Sunnis, even though there is talk of a unity government with all three. It will probably be the Shiites and the Kurds instead, both of whom have expressed a lot of interest in carving up the country into autonomous regions and securing the oil supplies for themselves. The Sunnis really don't have any of the oil reserves on their land, and that's one of the things that's worrying them a great deal. The other thing that was not widely reported this week is that Abdul Aziz al-Hakim of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution, that's the lead Shiite party, went back on his word that he gave before the constitutional vote last fall, when he said we've said on this program was very much an unfinished piece of work, very slipshod, done at the last minute, etc. They said they would be open to amendments to the Constitution after the vote, in order to give the Sunni minority more of a voice in the government. That was at the behest of the United States, was pushed very hard for it. It convinced some Sunnis to participate in the election. Last week, al-Hakim went back on his word. He said there would be no amendments, and the Shiites would rule, and the Sunnis could go stuff it, which is really a major development. It means that the Sunnis who participated in the last two elections, who tried to invest in the political process, maybe and maybe they didn't disavow the insurgency itself. Probably not. But what this says to them is that the political process was a waste of time, and they're going to turn back to the insurgency. They're going to target the Shiites. This pushes a step closer to all-out civil war, and it's a very, very worrisome development.
All right. Well, with that, we're pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a community paper. Comes out every other week, free of charge. You can find it at bookstores and cafes, coffee houses, places like that where you get free publications. You can also find us on the web, 10 years worth of back issues and the current issue as well, at www.eatthestate.org. We are an all-volunteer organization. We always look out for help, for writers, for distributors, for people to sell ads. We're looking for somebody to distribute in Fremont right now. We would love to have somebody to coordinate special events and fundraising concerts and things like that. We would love to have somebody to coordinate tabling at community fairs this summer. We don't have that right now. And, you know, there's some other volunteer needs that we have. So if you're interested in any of that, or if you're interested in helping out, or have any kind of feedback, tips, anything like that, contact us at eatthestate.org or give our voicemail a call. It's area code 206-719-6947.